It's great to be here. I'm losing my ear. So I'm excited to be here, and one of the things that I'll talk about tonight is the fact that things are always changing. So when I talk outside of IMS, I usually like to have a Socratic style, back and forth. I like to lecture a little bit and then have Q&A. And normally when I come here, I'm not able to do that, but tonight I am. And so everything I prepared for is out the window, pretty much, because I thought I had to speak for a long time, and Joseph said, you can do whatever you want. And so I like that. So I'm going to start off a little non-traditionally. So I made this charter. I don't know how many of you folks know what a charter is. It's basically a statement of a purpose or whatever. So my charter is... So my life, what I'm committing my life to do is to release the divine spark in every human being, and the values that are at the heart of who I am are love, curiosity, truth, wisdom, selfless service, and integrity. That for which I can be counted on for is to be loving with a warrior spirit, with a serving and compassionate heart, pursuing excellence and wisdom with grace and ease. So that's how I'm being. That's the game I'm playing. And so obviously, I'm pursuing excellence and wisdom with grace and ease. And the grace and ease is new. Before, I'd be pursuing it, but it wasn't so easy and it wasn't so graceful. So that's a new twist to it. So tonight's talk is about, is wisdom begins in wonder, and that is a Socrates quote. And so I want to just talk about the framework a little bit. Now, wisdom has many meanings. We've been talking about stuff, and in this tradition, when we think about wisdom, if we're talking about, because I know we have new folks, so I won't hit you with the 8 this and the 5 that, but I will summarize a little bit. So when you talk about the Eightfold Noble Path and you talk about wisdom, you're talking about right view and right intention. So that's the wisdom piece. And then when Joe was doing the precepts, we were talking about right speech, right action, right livelihood, which is the integrity piece or the morality piece. And then the one that you probably are accustomed to is the mental training. Some people call it the concentration piece. I don't like to call it the concentration piece because I think it's confusing what that means. So I mean mental training or mental development piece, which is right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And so all of these path factors work with each other. So they put them in three buckets: the wisdom piece, the morality piece, the mental training piece. And so when a lot of people talk about mindfulness, they're talking about the mental training, and they may not necessarily have the mindfulness grounded in right view, right intention, and morality piece. So it's threefold training. So when you think about it, so the wisdom piece is for, you know, to get to the root of the problem. The morality piece is when unwholesome mind states have arisen, these are things not to be done. Like you want to eat, you want to punch somebody, you want to you do something. Those hindrances, I mean, not the hindrances, but the precepts are to say that's not to be done. And why? Because it's grounded in right view, which has to do with the consequences to that is it's going to be harmful or it's going to cause suffering. And so the mental training piece, they all work together. So if the mental training piece, like if effort is not grounded in right view and right intention, it's not right effort. Same with mindfulness. If the mindfulness is not grounded in right view and right intention, is not right mindfulness. And if the concentration, same. It's not grounded in right view, right intention. It's not right concentration. And so when I used to do work in the prison, I saw some inmates in there that were very mindful, had tremendous effort and tremendous concentration, but they weren't really interested in your well-being, anybody's well-being. It was the wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration, because it was predicated on greed. And most of the inmates that are incarcerated, I say 90% of them have some kind of substance abuse issue, either on their way to getting substances or under the influence. So I would say that they know craving pretty well. And so when you look at it that way, and you look at, okay, so what does that mean for us? And so the wisdom piece, instead of giving you the whole doctrine on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, we can just break it down to what Joseph talked about, which is non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. And so if we start off with a mind that has an unwholesome mind state, like greed, then our intentions are not going to be wholesome. They're going to be unwholesome, and then our speech, right action, right livelihood is going to be unwholesome, and of course our mindfulness, our concentration, and our effort is going to be unwholesome. So, really, if you really think about it, the most important thing is the mind, the observing mind, the mind that we are observing with. And so if we go and sit down and we got a lot of hate on our mind, it's going to be an interesting sitting, or whatever you're doing, whatever you're interacting with. So these are the hate glasses. So everything gets colored by that. And so what needs to be done is we need to do the practice, but also keep checking in. What kind of attitude do we have, or what views are we operating from? Now, the interesting thing is most of us, especially the new folks that have come, we usually don't take that kind of inventory. We just do things and we may not be thinking about what we're doing and what the consequences are. You don't have to believe me. Just look at the political system or look at other people. They're doing things and they act like there's not going to be a consequence. And of course, when you use drugs and alcohol, it's like, okay, one drug is too many and not enough. So you got to ask yourself, okay, is it worth it? Now, we could be talking about food. We could talk about any of our addictions we have. If we don't abstain from them, if we don't get to the root cause of that craving or why we're doing it, we're going to keep doing it. So we have to have some kind of wisdom, some kind of understanding. So the wisdom piece is really important. So knowing what our intentions are, knowing how we're seeing things, if we have a mind full of curiosity or generosity, it's going to be different than a mind full of hate or fear. And so just to start off with that, so to do this work is very challenging, extremely challenging. And so we have to have some way of speaking for my own practice. I came here because there was a lot of dukkha, a lot of suffering. And then once I got here, what kept me here is this pursuit of excellence and wisdom with grace and ease, or the joy of discovery. Wisdom begins in wonder. And so beginning it, the practice, and beginning doing this work from a place of wonder. Just imagine that. What is wonder? And so I'm going to read you a definition of wonder, and it's very appropriate for the practice we're doing. So wonder is the unwilled willingness to meet what is utterly strange and what is most familiar. It is the willingness to step back and let things speak to us, a passive receptivity to let the things of the world present themselves in their own terms. So I'm going to read that one again. Wonder is the unwilled willingness to meet what is utterly strange and what is most familiar. It is a willingness to step back and let things speak to us, a passive receptivity to let the things of the world present themselves in their own terms. And so I can relate to this going back to when I got out of the detox and I was walking home, and it's the first time I saw my street because I didn't have all that stuff there. And then the interesting thing is, I have not really talked about this, but I lived at the Cambridge Center for 6 years. I used to be on a board here, so I've been coming here for over 30 years. And every time I did a long retreat or did a retreat, which I did a lot of, whether it was the 3 months or 10 days or 14 days, when I go back to Cambridge, it would take me a couple of days to get used to being back. And that was another meditation center I was going to. So this is what happens is it changes, it transforms how we're being, and it can be unsettling going back home, especially in Cambridge. You go back and you know there's, and even when I do things in Cambridge, the intellect is really strong there, so they ask a lot of questions, and you know it's like you get stuck in that mental space, and it's kind of hard to drop down to the heart. So at least that's my judgment of it when I used to go back, and I'd go to certain meetings and I'd be around certain people, and that was, but they didn't have a practice. And so when I talk about wisdom begins in wonder, we can approach this, even sitting on the cushion, like this is going to be an adventure. So there's a sense of wonder there. And the interesting thing is when you do this practice, because here's what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to watch your breath or sit and be still. And I don't know, there's thousands of breaths a day. And you're doing the same thing over and over. And if you have the mind like, okay, this is boring, you know, it's just not getting it. We have to have this ability to have a beginner's mind to see things fresh in a new way. But to do that, that takes something. That takes a tremendous amount of trust, because what am I asking you to do? To be vulnerable. And act like you don't know what's going on. And to look at it and to see it fresh every time. And that's what's possible with the practice of mindfulness, with the practice of developing the spiritual powers like trust, like diligence or effort, concentration, wisdom. That we need to develop these things so that we can see things fresh and new. Because I don't want to break the illusion, but we act like we know what's going to happen the next moment. And we really don't. We really don't. And there's a military term that they use called VUCA, V-U-C-A. And what it means is volatile, uncertain, ambiguous, and complex. So everything is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. But we act like, oh no, it's the same. And so if we keep seeing things the same, they keep being the same. And so this idea of wonder and really investigating, what is this? How am I relating to my experience? How am I causing suffering for myself? Uh-oh. What do you mean, George? I'm causing suffering for myself. You are. We are. And Albert Einstein said, the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we first created them. Uh-oh. And so that honesty of really being able to look at our stuff with like a beginner's mind or like children, because if you look at a baby when they're learning how to walk, their whole world is wonder. You know, you can give them a shake, and they can shake that thing for 2 hours, and they'd be cool. But then when they learn how to walk, right, they get up, they fall down. They don't fall down and get up like, oh, man, my mother's making me do this. They don't do that. Or they don't. And when they fall down, they don't turn around and look to see who saw them fall. And they don't come up with this false premise that says, okay, I'm going to try it for 2 hours, and if it doesn't work, I'm done. It doesn't work like that. And so some of us, we get to the place where we matriculate through high school and college, and then we're done with learning. No, we're not. Because things are changing all the time, and if we're not learning and we're not evolving with that change, we get left behind. And I remember reading Thomas Friedman's book, Thank You for Being Late, and he said that because of globalization, climate change, and technological change, that things are changing at an accelerated rate, and it takes people about 5 to 10 years before they get used to a new platform. So you might think about Obamacare. It took like 9 years before people figured out, okay, well, maybe this is okay. And most platforms don't last 5 years. So if it takes you 10 years to adapt and it only lasts 5 years, by the time you learn the other one, you're 2 iterations behind. So maybe you learn how to use an iPhone 5 and now we're up to 10 or 11. So that's the world that we're faced with. And so one of the things I like to talk about is if we see things as wondering like a child, we don't stop learning. We keep learning, growing, and developing. And but the thing we got to learn is, who are we? How are we being? You know, how are we seeing things? Right view? What are our intentions? Are they wholesome or are they unwholesome? Is our speech wholesome or unwholesome? Are our actions causing harm or not? What kind of job do we have? You know, are we selling drugs or engaging in prostitution or trafficking in human beings? That there's a consequence to that. And that the mindfulness that we're developing, this ability to be present and to be with ourselves, that is precious. And the thing I want to mention from the beginning is human birth is very precious. And that we all have Buddha nature, Christ consciousness, or the divine spark, however you want to call it. So we're wired for success, but how we relate to our experience is huge. So you know 90% of our long-term happiness is predicated on how the brain interprets our experience. 90%, not 10. 90%. And that if you start off with a sense of wonder or in a wholesome mind state, then your cognitive functioning is going to be enhanced. And here's the fallacy that I want to address right away. We think that when we get the relationship we want, or we have enough sittings that we love, that we're going to be happy. Or there's something out there is going to make us happy. But the research says you're happy first, then you're successful. Why? Because it's the happiness advantage. It's this idea that when your cognitive functioning is enhanced, then you see more, you're thinking properly, and then the scenarios you play out in your head when you have a problem or you have an argument with somebody are positive. Imagine that. That's why we've known it for 2,600 years. We call it right effort. The effort to abandon or to prevent unwholesome thoughts or mind states from arising, and then to abandon them when they arise. And then the other part of that is how do we bring into existence a wholesome mind state that's not in existence? And then once we get it into existence, how do we maintain it? So if we think about the mood of wonder, if we approach everything with this openness, with seeing things in a fresh way, just imagine what impact that's going to have on how we think, how we feel, how we behave. And so we need right effort, because you got to have effort. You make the effort. When you make the effort, you can be more mindful. When you can be more mindful, you get some concentration, but also the mindfulness by itself, as Joseph said, is not enough. We have to have this idea of mindfulness, but clearly knowing, or some wisdom there. And if we think of wisdom as information, intellect, and direct experience or intuition. So the idea of this practice is, okay, we give you some teachings. The idea is to go into yourself and see if it's true, so that you have a direct experience of the teaching, a subjective experience of what is being offered. Then you go from faith to conviction. And if you do it properly and you do it enough times, you develop what we call strong self-efficacy belief, or resilience, however you want to call it. And then when you have that, what happens? What happens is when something happens, because one of the things that the research says that you can predict somebody's success in a job by three factors. One is what they call positive genius, or optimism and hope, or a positive mindset, social support. And the third thing is how the person reacts or responds to stress. If they see something as a curse rather than a challenge, then they don't do so well. But if they see it as a challenge, then you experience what they call eustress, which is a kind of stress that makes you stronger. And so the rich get richer. So when you have some strong self-efficacy, what happens is, because you know no matter what happens to you, between the space of stimulus and response, you get to choose how you're going to be. So in the space of stimulus and response, I get to choose, love, curiosity, wisdom, integrity, selfless service. So around here, we might talk about generosity, compassion, love and kindness, appreciative joy. So you get what I'm saying. So it's really, this is so simple, it's ridiculous. But it's simple, but not easy. I think I heard Joseph say something like that the other day, right? You know, Munindraji said, you know, it's easy. It's simple, but not easy. But that's what does this mean? So this says that if we can have this mood of wonder from moment to moment, from the time we wake up to the time we go to sleep, it has nothing to do with sitting and being still. Although it will enhance that, because we talk about the continuity of practice. So from the time we wake up to the time we go to sleep, or really go to sleep, we can say, well, you know, what's my attitude? How's my body feeling? How's the energy? How am I seeing things? Is there a wholesome mindset? How's my attitude? Because where I grew up, when somebody says you have attitude, that's not a good thing. Oh, he got an attitude. But here, when we talk about attitude, we're really talking about how you're seeing the world. So we live into the world we see. So if we see the world is unfriendly, then we're going to be in survival mode. And if we see the world as, you know, I can do the proverbial half empty, half full, the cup or the bottle, say a cup, half empty, half full. Both are right, but one of them has but there's a consequence of how you see that. If you see it as half empty, then you're in survival mode. And here's the interesting thing, and this is on a cellular level. You cannot be in survival mode and growth mode at the same time. So we definitely want to be in survival mode, but we don't want to deny what's there, but we can relate to it in a way where we have space between stimulus and response. And as Joseph was talking about, when we can have that space and we can see things, then we can see them clearly, because the typical way we observe things is something happens, and then there's a very short amount of time where it's pure, you know, just the data. And then we project on self-interest. That's the main one, self-interest, associative thinking, abstract thinking, embellishing. Oh, yeah, I've seen that before. So then we project what we know onto what's happening instead of being open and saying, okay, that was then. The conditions were different. Now it's different. We need a way of perception that allows us to see the truth, because when you see the truth, it sets you free. So 2016 election night, I'm teaching a retreat with Narayan at CIMC, and we're on our way home, and we say, okay, we got to meet tomorrow, and this dude just won the election. And people were traumatized, and I was traumatized. And I kept thinking it was like devastating. And then once I turned in and said, okay, he won, once I accepted that, I had a lot of peace. Interesting. Just made space for it and said, okay, man, okay, it's interesting. Now, how do I relate to this? I can relate to this as this is the worst thing ever. And that could be part of it. That's the crisis thing, the danger. Then the opportunity is, now all that racism and all that misogyny is going to be on the surface. Now, are we going to work with it, or are we going to let it slip back down? So this is an opportunity for us to really understand what it means to have inclusion, what it means to be fighting with forces that are beyond our control. That this path that we're on, we have the ability to transform and also transform the planet, not just ourselves. And so when wisdom begins in wonder, you got to have have this childlike idea that I don't really care what happens. It's going to be great because I get to choose how I'm going to be. That self efficacy. And what happens is when you have high self-efficacy, like I said, you make sure you set more challenging goals, and you persevere when things get difficult. And then you get to the point where you learn for learning's sake. So you get in the process of learning, not so much what you're going to get out of it. The achievement is it'll be there, but it's the learning process, becoming learners. And I know that's working with elite performance. We talk about learning, practicing, and performing. So you learn certain things, and then you practice them, and then whether they work or not determines what you go back and learn and practice some more. And so I would say learning, practicing, experiencing for us. And the ultimate is we want to get to a place, we call it the zone of flow in sports, but we really call it spontaneity. Can we be spontaneous? Especially if we train ourselves to be compassionate spontaneously, or loving, or being a service spontaneously, because it means a free will. That means that we got rid of all the noise and clutter and all the I, me, and mine, and we realize that this illusion of separateness is just that. And every once in a while, we break that field of that illusion, which usually like the marathon bombing, 9/11, you know, when you had the catastrophes in Puerto Rico and Texas, and even in California with the mudslides and the fires. Every once in a while, we forget about, you know, what race or gender or political persuasion we are, and we just connect because we know that I and the other are one. We get beyond this illusion of separateness. Every once in a while we do that, and when you're in flow and when you're spontaneous, there's no you there. Because you hear people say it, yeah, you know, it's just flowing, it happens. Well, okay, what does that mean? That means I got out of the way and it's just happening. Zen in the Art of Archery talks about it, so you know, Zen, you know, it shoots. Well, what does that mean? That means that there's no selfing there, there's nobody there. The arrow and the bow and the target are one. And so we can train like that and realize that, but I have to be one with myself. I have to have my mind, body, heart, and spirit or soul, however you want to say it, on the same page. And then when I can have peace in myself, then I can help have peace out there. And so this whole idea of, you know, I could talk on and on about it, and people have said different things about, but just something as simple as, you know, practicing happiness. Because I read, I think it was Pericles that said, happiness is the secret to freedom, and freedom is the secret to courage. So that courage is the main deal, is we got to get to a level of courage where we're willing to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because I'm going to be really clear about this. As you develop and you grow, one side of the coin is potential and, you know, spiritual growth. The other side is anxiety. Because you're going into something you don't know. I said VUCA, right? Volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. I mean, I had experience today where I'm preparing for my talk and I get a call from home telling me that my brother's on life support and they're going to pull the plug and I got to come home. And so I had to call my brothers. I called everybody. Of course, they're not answering because they're in the hospital. Then I called and I find out that they misspoke. They were just taking a tube out of his nose. So I could have been crying and anguishing and all that. And I was just sitting there saying, oh, this is interesting. In the eye of the hurricane, just being calm. I didn't have to try. It's programmed. I said, well, let me see. That's what they say, but let me see what's true. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here giving this talk. I'd be on the road. And then I get there and they say, oh, you didn't have to come home. How many times we do stuff like that, we just jump and we just assume. Instead of just being still and seeing what's from moment to moment, we have no idea what's going to happen. But if we have this ability to be still and know or have that space so we can just choose how we're going to respond to the situation, that's freedom. And that space, that's what Viktor Frankl says, between space between stimulus and response is we can choose. And that's how we exercise our freedom and power. So even if it did happen, I still get to choose how I'm going to relate to that situation. And can I relate in a way that enhances my ability to have peace and to see what's happening? Because my brother is interesting. He's about 12 years older than me, but you know, dude went to Vietnam twice and been through all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, it's like, I remember when I was in high school, worried about him being over Vietnam, whether he's going to come home. And so that's what we all have loved ones. We have no idea what's going to happen. And so this is really about having this sense of wonder or being on an adventure and understanding the joy of discovery is really, really powerful. If we allow ourselves to experience that. And it's not like we don't go through suffering or we don't go through it, but when we can, you know, like Thoreau talked about it, when we can see meaning in suffering, it ceases to be suffering. When we can see, okay, this is what happens. We grow, we get sick, and we die. We experience something really nice, and we know it's not going to last. And the thing we don't understand is things are not feeling so well. That ain't going to last either. But we act like it is, right? It makes sense. We think, oh, it's just never going to end. I remember a friend of mine told me when I started doing this, feelings can't kill you. And I said, I'm glad you told me that one, because I was feeling like I was going to die. These feelings are awful. So we start to see what's true, and we start to really understand, and then we do it together. And so maybe I'll just end with talking about the four virtues. And the four virtues are this idea that good friends, like teachers, we call each other good friends, and fellow yogis, and then good teachings, or what we call appropriate conversation, suitable conversation. Then there's wise reflection. We actually get to reflect on what we're about to do and what the consequences of that are going to be. So we reflect before, during, and after. And even just thinking about it, if you reflect before you sit on your cushion or before you go on a walk, okay, so what am I doing and why am I here, and what's the best way to do this? So I'm going to sit down and just sit and just be with my breath and see what comes up. Or I'm going to go for a walk and I'm going to act like I've never been on a walk before. And I'm going to see it with fresh eyes and just be there. And even when we're not, we can keep practicing. That's why we call it practice. You keep doing it. You keep doing it. And so we know that there's this ability to really understand that we were wired, you know, for awakening. Now, how we relate to our experience is going to determine that. What kind of habits of mind we have. What kind of practice we have, if we have right view and right intention, and then everything else is going to line up appropriately. But that's too simple. I'd rather go sit down and I'm pissed off and I work through it. Yeah, I'm feeling, instead of just saying, okay, why don't you let go, dude? And just, you know, maybe you can forgive that person or send them some love and kindness. Now, I'm not saying doing it in order to get rid of it. I'm saying really embracing whatever I'm experiencing, knowing it and dealing with it, like, okay, Trump is president. That's the only way I can make peace with it. I accept it, and then I can come from the, you know, there's action from that. So it's awareness, acceptance, and then compassionate action. There's another military term called OODA, O-O-D-A. Observe, orient, decide, and enact. And so when we talk about the decision part, if you see clearly, then you orient. What that means is you orient it. Okay, this is what's happening. What are my choices? And then you decide the choice, and then you have action. But we look at, is it wholesome or is it unwholesome? Is it helpful or is it not helpful? So we reflect. If it's going to hurt me or hurt somebody else, it's not to be done. If it's going to hurt me and not somebody else, is not to be done. If it's going to hurt somebody else and not me, it's not to be done. And so we can reflect, just a simple reflection, how am I doing? What's my attitude? How's it going? Am I struggling? And even if you don't know, all you have to do is watch your body. If you're sitting and breathing and you're moving out to catch the breath before it comes, there's probably some greed there. And if you're moving away from it or avoiding, there's probably some aversion there. And if you're doing neither and spacing out, then that's probably sloth and torpor or dull mind, means that there's delusion. You have no idea what you're doing. So this is a nervous system. It's not personal. Everybody has a nervous system. When it perceives a threat, fight, flight, or freeze. So we want to create this situation where we observe things. So instead of going flight or fright, we have this ability to stay open so that we have access to our memory. Because when we get stressed out, that freezes. It's like no RAM. You can't get to it. So there's a consequence to how we see things is really important. And if we see that we have the ability to create space between stimulus and response, and we get to choose what values we're going to have. So we talk about the precepts. You take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. What does that mean? The Buddha means we got Buddha nature. That's all it is. So when you bow into the statue, you're really bowing to your Buddha nature. You're not bowing to some statue. And we have teachings that lead to liberation. And so we can do those teachings. And we have a Sangha that helps us with that. And then those precepts keeps everybody safe, and they keep us from creating more suffering as a consequence of our behavior right now. And then, of course, when you're doing the other stuff, you put all of the hindrances in abeyance. We'll talk about that at some point. But when you start getting, when you apply thought and it sustains, and then you feel some happiness and you feel some joy or happiness, you have this kind of like excitation, then happiness, and then you have one-pointedness. You don't have to really get into it, but this is what happens. And sometimes people get in a deep concentration and they feel like, oh, I've arrived, I'm enlightened. I don't realize after they get out of that concentration state, they can be a bigger fool than they were before with more energy. Just say it. Because without the wisdom piece, it's a problem. So I'm talking from my own personal experience, so I'm copying it. Yeah, I've done that, been concentrated, and then been crazy afterwards. So I don't want to talk a lot more. I think I talked enough. I'll make sure I said a lot. So maybe I'll read a quote from T.S. Eliot. He says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." So that's the amazing journey we're on, and it's up to us to decide if we want to roll with it or we want to just suffer and just say, okay, life is hard, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to do that lone warrior energy instead of that compassionate warrior that says, okay, I can work hard, but I have to have compassion. I have to have care for myself and others. So that's why I said pursuing excellence and wisdom with grace and ease. There's an ease to it. And the effort we take, and I'll mention a little bit, I talked about the five spiritual powers. So there's been a lot of discussion about trying too hard. So if it's all efforting, it's usually some hindrance that's driving that. And we're trying too hard, and then what we need to do is bring more poise and more steadiness of mind to it to balance it. And of course, some of us have too much steadiness of mind, then we have the sloth and torpor. I had it this morning for the first time in a long, long time. And it's like, okay, so now you got to raise your energy. And the mindfulness helps develop those qualities, but also helps to balance them. And so if you have too much information and you know too much and you're cynical, that's saying you got to work on faith. You got to bring more faith in. And it's okay to have faith, but we can verify it. So when we ask you to sit and breathe and know you're sitting and breathing, you don't have to take our word for it. You can feel it. You know, you can feel your touch points. It's consistent with sitting. Oh, you proved that. So you don't have to say, oh, yeah, he said that, but you can know it. Same with walking. Your body is moving forward or backwards or sideways. You know that. But usually our mind is somewhere else and we're here, but we're not with the body. And I like to say, have your body and mind at the same place at the same time. That would be a good idea. But a lot of times we don't do that. But not only be there, but to observe it in a way that's wholesome and compassionate. So just this idea of, you know, any positive mindset, anytime we can change the mind from unwholesome to wholesome, it's a good idea. So if we're struggling, we got to look at, okay, so what's my attitude? Because sometimes we have this idea that what's happening should not be happening. You notice that? And everything that's happening is happening because it has a nature to arise, because the conditions are right. So if we see it as nature, oh, this is not personal, it's the conditions are there. But if you know the conditions for how you can abandon it or prevent it, then that works to our advantage. So that's why we're here. We talk about it. I call them championship conversations. We need to have conversations on how do we do this, not conversations where it doesn't work and why isn't it working? No, how do you do it? Let's focus on what we want rather than focusing on what we don't want. And so I'll end the talk there, and I'll open it up for questions. Yes.
Thank you so much for your wonderful talk, because I love the relatability and your tone and your manner of speaking. I just really, it speaks to me, so thank you. You mentioned your family, and I think it's been said that, like, oh, yeah, you think you've been practicing, go home and spend time with your family, right? And then they also, I've heard say, the Buddha, I believe it was a Buddhist who said, Well, if you don't have anybody but like one person who understands, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to do, then, you know, abandon the folks that kind of don't get it, so to speak. Not abandon, but like, better to have one good friend. You probably know this teaching better than me, but like, better to have one good friend than to spend a lot of time with people who may not be understanding what you're trying to do. So I'm finding that I'm trying to have this balance between compassion and leaving space with folks to come forward, perhaps, if they, you know, whatever, and recognize and be mindful that it's not aversive. Mm-hmm. But then also sort of just say, well, maybe this is the time to be spending time cultivating something without so much engagement with family. Can you say anything more about that?
Yeah, good luck with that one. No, I'm teasing you. this is where the practice where you go inside and you have to ask yourself, you know, and you start seeing, well, what do you want? See, that's always the question. What do you want? If you want, because it's interesting with my family, they don't meditate. They don't go to 12-step meetings and stuff like that. So when I go around them, I tolerate them and I know what I'm going to get. But I'm not going to spend too much time with, especially the ones that are still active, I'm not going to spend too much time with them. But there's a tolerance and there's a compassion for them, and I pray for them, and I leave it open that they can come and I could help them. But the main thing is on me getting clear and me being peaceful and me being at ease with who I am. And then when I go around them, I could, you know, like I said, that being a service or just being with them and you have to find the balance. But the question is, my dad told me this years ago, and it's amazing how wise he gets as I get older. When he first told me, I said, he's drunk, he don't know what he's talking about. But it turns out, he said, be careful who you hang with. So if you want to go to college, hang out with Joe College. If you want to go to jail, hang out with the jailbirds. So it's kind of like if the Buddha talks about, if you want peace, hang out with people who are peaceful. If you want to be wise, hang out with the wise ones. And so it doesn't mean you have to stay with them and not, never go back, but you can figure out what you need and what you really want. Because if you have the survivor's guilt or you think like you should be doing something, that word should is telling you that's a judgment. And so just do what you are doing. And I know in my own recovery, people stopped drinking because they seen how I changed. And then they say, well, what's this meditation thing you're doing? And then they want to do that. Of course, my younger brother would call me Kwai Shai Kane, who is the character on Kung Fu, because he said, okay, this dude just did a 3-month retreat, and he's into that Tai Chi and all that stuff. Hey, Kai, you know, that's his way. Hey, that's how he called me. He said, yeah, he's Kung Fu. But that's how he could relate to me, and it was cool. It was cool, but you get what I'm saying? Because they said, yeah, dude, he went away, you know. And my mother said, oh, well, he looks all right. But then they realized, oh, man, I keep doing what you're doing, dude, because it's better than what you were doing. But you get what I'm saying? But the newness, right? Because that's the VUCA thing. That's the volatile uncertain. So when something is out of our comfort zone, we don't understand, we make other. Instead of opening up and saying, well, why don't I seek to understand, then seek to be understood. So it's just talking about it and saying, well, what do you want? And having a conversation about life or how you're going to do something. But when we're trying to fix somebody, and I when I talk with people who are going out and teaching mindfulness, and the first thing I tell them is, you ain't fixing nobody. You know, what you want to look at is that they're already okay. You just want to help them get cognizant to that, to be mindful of the fact that they can do that. But if you're going and fixing them and you're relating to them like something's wrong, that's a problem. And so when we think we know better and somebody should be doing something that we're doing, we got to look at that energy, because that they're probably going to respond to that or react to that energy rather than realizing, okay, just do you and then, you know, see what happens. Does that make sense? So, but it's you decide how much you want to do and how much, you know, what's your intention? Once again, what's your intention? Is your intention to spend time with them, or your intention with them to spend time with them, but they have to change? Yeah, I know that, but I'm just saying, just think about it that way. And if you just want to spend time with them, just spend time with them. Don't make it complicated. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I have a question. Thanks again so much for the talk. What if you have to spend time with the people? Like, I'm living right now with a roommate who's, like, very mean, yells at me, and, like, insults me, and I don't feel safe there. You mentioned how, like, it's hard to grow when you're in fight or flight, yet I go home and the dog, like, did me, and I just don't feel safe. And I came, the first time it happened, I just got back from a communication retreat with Oren, and I was, like, being so compassionate, she was just yelling at me, and I was just, like, stick, okay? Well, are you okay? Like, but then the next time I didn't put up with it, like, please, like, you know, don't yell at me. But now it's just like I go home, and every time I go home, like, the dogs are barking, and I just don't feel safe, and I'm paying rent, so I can't leave the house. Like, I'm staying with other friends sometimes when I really can't handle it. But, like, how do I abide in that situation, like, and feel like I can grow and not, and, like, you know, take it as a challenge and not feel like, I don't know, I can fight or flight all the time?
Yeah, so you can... You know you're in that situation. Obviously, you want to try to get out, but while you're there, you want to not react so much.
Yeah.
And so, and then you have to create a little space, like maybe you have your own room or whatever, and maybe you just go there, and then you set limits, and you know, the dog barking, there's not much you can do about that, but you just go into your space, you do what you need to do, and then when you get a chance, you got to get out of there. But what will happen is if you change, he won't want you there anyway.
She.
Or she, whatever. Because now it's different. That's what I've experienced. But it's really about you having a plan for how you can figure out how to get to another place, a safe place, and just be there. But then figure out, you know, did you sign a lease or something?
No, it's month to month. I just have all this stuff going on.
Okay.
No, I gotta find a place.
So here's what I would say. Maybe your butt is not on fire enough for you to just leave. See, there's a payoff there somewhere, maybe. Yeah, well, why would you want to be on eggshells?
I don't.
Okay, so you know what to do. I don't have to tell you. But, you know, you can do what you're doing, and if you're getting what you're getting, if nothing changed, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
You've had quite a journey, and speak eloquently about that. I guess what, at this juncture in your life, what is it in your practice that is a struggle for you? Those of us beginning that look at you as you've reached some plateau. What is the struggle for you at this point?
I think that changes right now. Usually a struggle, I won't even say a struggle, but the difficulty that I experience, right, what I realize is that, you know, I still have chronic pain, and I still get, you know, headaches or like family matters and stuff like that. But the struggle is really, how can I be less reactive? So even though I'm way more less reactive than I used to be, there's still room for improvement. But it's not a struggle. It's more like pursuing excellence and wisdom. So, but I do struggle when I forget what I'm teaching, when I forget that it's not personal, when I forget that it's impermanent, when I forget that it's not me. So I like to use the analogy of the eye of the hurricane. So, you know, we have this ability of being that eye, and all around us is the whirlwind and turmoil. And every once in a while, my head gets out there, and I think I'm part of it. And it's really simple, like, dude, you know, how's that working for you? Then, So I get identified with things. Anybody have that problem? Get identified with your anger, or somebody's doing it, they're doing it to me because they don't like me, and we're inside their head telling them why. So yeah, so the struggle of being a human being continues. So, and I, you know, every once in a while, like I said, you know, I will notice that I'm causing suffering or I'm reacting to something, and then I can always say, okay, so what is the best way, how can I relate to this situation in a way that empowers me? And a lot of times that has to do with forgive, forget. And just realize that, yeah, I have to do this practice. I have to do the things we're talking about. And the best way to learn something is to teach it. Now, it's interesting because I had no idea. I had no desire to be a teacher. But, you know, one of my teachers, Larry Rosenberg, said to me, hey, why don't you teach? I said, I don't want to teach. He said, that's why I think you should teach. See, this is what these meditation teachers like. They're like that, you know. They throw curves at you. they take things away from you. Hey, but it's with compassion. It's with love. So yeah. So I say the struggle is that this is, you know, some days are better than others. But the idea is sustainability. It's the continuity of the mindfulness. The continuity of starting over again. So I make mistakes. Yeah, I might blow a gasket, especially if you see me driving my car in Boston. You say, who's that dude? That's not the same dude that teaches. I don't know who that dude is. But even there, I'm learning compassion. See, that's that's, you know, they say in martial arts, the dojo is the place of enlightenment. My place of enlightenment is in my car. So we all have a place where we have a performance challenge that's not really where we want it to be. Sigmund Freud said the idea is to work, love, and play at our highest capacities. If you got all three of those things going on, you're doing really well. Usually you got one, maybe two, but not all three. There's always a challenge, and maybe it's because of time, maybe it's because of the conditioning, and it just needs more work. But yeah, I would say yes, you know, I've been through a lot, but there's a lot I don't know, and there's a lot of there's things that I can change, but a day at a time, and, you know, just, you know, working incrementally, you know, just today, I just be a little bit better today than I was yesterday is enough. Yes, ma'am.
I'm curious if you could speak more about anxiety, which you mentioned.
Yes.
And I've dealt with it on and off since I've been here. And the mind is so convincing that when these thoughts of panic or anxiety come up, it's saying, like, you need to do something about this. Like, this is real. And my whole world believes that. It's like the Einstein quote that you said, consciousness can't solve it. So how do you know when the panic is okay and you just need to put a pin in it, in the thought, and set it aside, versus, like, what is actually the mind telling you that I do need to deal with right now?
Yes, so the anxiety, part of the anxiety is a conflict. You know, it's like not knowing what's going to happen, right? And usually when you have anxiety, it's usually about something that you're projecting into the future, or you're trying to avoid reliving the past. And in this moment, because like I would say right now, in this moment, there's nothing wrong. Can you feel that? Don't think. Can you feel, yeah, right now it's okay. Yeah, but that's what you're about to hear, right? Yeah, exactly. So it's like, so if you can have a moment of that and you can just say, okay, just be with whatever it is, and you can get comfortable being uncomfortable, then you won't listen, because that voice is coming from an unwholesome mind state. Yeah, so there's a conflict, because so it's like, okay, like I'm sick and I don't want to be sick, but they treat me really nice. So maybe I want to stay sick a little bit more because I get that TLC. You know what I'm saying? So there's a conflict. But then when we decide, no, we can let go of this and we can be happy, because this isn't the source of our happiness, or I'm not going to be happy. I'm going to be happy when I get rid of anxiety and I never feel it. Well, I hate to, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you, I trauma kicks up with me a lot sometimes. Sometimes I'll be, I remember being at a meeting with a professional team, and voice says, you don't belong here. Who do you think you are? But because I had that space, I can just notice, okay, that's the negative committee. I don't have to listen to that. And then I might answer and say, well, what do you know? You understand what I'm saying? So you start to understand that if you can get comfortable, and what if the anxiety was teaching you something about something, and maybe it was like a door, you can just walk through it. So there's anxiety that we have as a consequence of normal anxiety. Then there's anxiety that's kind of morphed into a neurosis or a psychosis because we have not made peace with it, or not accepted anxiety is part of life. You know, the fear of death, you know, fear of being alone is very existential. But the way we get through it is full, you know, full engagement, just saying, okay, I'm just going to do this thing for today. And, you know, if I die, then I die. But sometimes when we, my own experience, the more I grow, the more I have to let go, and it's like little deaths. Like the old George had to die, because if that George was still alive, I wouldn't be here with you all. I'd be, who knows, I'd probably be dead or some institution or something. So it's really understanding, well, what is this anxiety? And then explore, what is it? What does it feel like in the body? Because on some level, the cause of the suffering is we have not accepted that it's there. And you might have to take medicine. I'm not one that says you shouldn't do whatever you have to do, but if you get to a place of wonder and say, what is this? And you look at it and you explore it like you want to know how it affects you and how you can manage it. That's a different orientation. So I talked about UDA, you know, observe, orient, decide, and act. And so you act, other people, well, how do you deal with anxiety? Anxiety is just a mind state. And then the interesting thing about it is, based on the happiness advantage data, they have these research habits that you can practice, like meditation, make you happy. Three conscious smiles, right? Something like acts of kindness that you give to somebody without being found out. If you have a good experience, you can write about it, and then you experience it again. It's called the doubler. So these habits of being happy, something to look forward to. But it's interesting that meditation is a really good form, just sitting and observing your breath for 2 minutes and just like we talked, that's a real source of happiness. And so what happens is when you do happiness, it reduces depression by 31%. It affects anxiety. It changes a lot of different things just by being happy. So I said happiness is the secret to freedom, and freedom is the secret to courage. But we have to have the courage to do it differently, to see it differently. Then when we change the way we see things, the things we look at change. So once again, it's the mind state. If you start dealing with the mind state and abandoning that mind state and bringing mindfulness or love, compassion into it, you'll have a different experience. So it's the anxiety, but then there's the relationship to it and trying to get rid of it, which doesn't work. Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite there yet. I feel like the last year I've kind of assumed a mission of trying to educate the world that, you know, we've gone through this before, you know, we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. And just try to be an advocate for greater compassion. That, you know, we are human creatures, and
So when you say it's not working, what informs you that it's not working?
A lot of things. I mean, conversations with people who I disagree with, not seeing how much progress there. Actually, to some extent, seeing progress of the alternative ideas.
So so you have a timetable for when it should work?
Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Yeah,
so I guess what I'm suggesting is we do things and we don't see the results right away, so we might be discouraged from doing them instead of continuing to do what we know to be right and not to be so concerned about the results, although we want to know if we need to change or adapt. But I like that spiritual saying, like, if you're doing something, even if you do it 70 times 7, right? It's not really a number. What it's really saying is do it until you can do it. So that's where when you have faith and you know it's going to make a change, you'll continue to do it even though the environment is not showing you any progress. So what if success was a progressive realization of a worthy goal? So progress, and you know, it takes time. Progress, not perfection. It takes time. And so I like to remind people, when we sit and we meditate and we make peace with ourselves, that ripples through the whole planet. It's not just us. So sometimes it's like, for me, a lot of my clients are traumatized, the people I work with. So I help them make peace with it. And so it means that what I'm doing became more important than it was before. And so I want to reach more people and talk about it. And just like the Buddha, the practice of loving kindness is very helpful. You know, just sending compassion or thinking about people or looking at the people that aren't getting it and seeing that they're you know, through ignorance or whatever, they're suffering. And even when they don't agree with you, it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with their mindset. Not so much yours. So if you take care of you and realize that, you know, you're doing all you can do, then you need to let it go and just say, okay, forget about the results. Just focus on what you're doing. But if every day you're attending to yourself and you're being as peaceful and as compassionate as you can be, and that can be enough. But if you have this idea that you should be doing more, then you got to look at that expectation, whether it's realistic or not. Because sometimes I see this with myself and with people like parents or coaches. When you want it more than the other person does, that's a problem. So they have to meet you halfway. They have to take responsibility. That's where this thing about right effort is so important, because even though one size fits all, everybody has to work out their own way of liberation. You have to figure out what works for you. How are you going to do it? How are you going to deal with this situation? So if there's unhappiness there, then you look and see what's the cause of that. There's a cause to it. And you look at it and you can transform that. Because right now, if we're looking for like 10% of what makes us happy is out there. The other 90% is your interpretation of what happens. So something happens and you interpret what it means. So if you interpret it in a way that causes suffering, maybe you want to change the way you're looking at it. Yes, ma'am.
I'm new to studying Buddhism, but I'm not new to the 12 steps. And I hear a lot of what I hear you saying is very closely aligned with the 12 step program. And I wonder if you could reflect just for a moment on how closely aligned are they, in your opinion?
How closely aligned? I just taught a workshop last week in Cambridge Center. It was called Connecting to Higher Power, Insight Meditation and the 11th Step. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve conscious contact with God, praying or your higher power, praying for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. It's about power. It's about connecting to higher power. It's about connecting to higher consciousness. And the thing I love about it is, so when I first got in recovery, Larry Rosenberg, my teacher, and I used to identify as a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, whatever, and he said, you need to let go of that. He said, stop labeling, because the label is causing you to be a certain thing. But what helped me was the five precepts. abstaining from intoxicants. You know, and so when you talk about the steps and you talk about, you know, letting go and or turning it over or realizing you don't have to believe in a higher power, but you got to realize that your best thinking didn't help you. So you have to have some humility and connect to a process that works. And so it's very compatible in terms of dealing with, like we talk about, halt, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. You know, when you're under that, under those unwholesome mind states, that you're going to either drink a drug or you're going to have some stinking thinking, right? That's what we call stinking thinking, which here we call it wrong views. but you get what I'm saying, or wrong intentions. So you look at it from the vantage point of developing your own mind body and seeing how we get the craving and attachment and ignorance causes suffering. So you have to understand how to use the process to help you remove yourself. So in 12 steps, you know, you do the steps. That's what helps you. And so the 11th step is, you know, just meditation and prayer. Prayer here might be, you know, you could view metta, compassion, you know, all of those Brahma Viharas as prayer, or especially with the Buddha, he used to send love and kindness out to the whole world. And so even though he's enlightened, he was always sensitive to the suffering beings, and he wanted all beings to not suffer. And so when you think about it, so there's a lot of parallels, but the main thing is this idea of when you're at a certain consciousness level, the choices that you were making are going to be different, because the choices available to you at a higher consciousness level is going to be different. So for me, the reason I don't drink or drugs is because I'm at a consciousness level where that's not an option. And so when they say improve conscious contact, is another way of saying get more clarity, get more wisdom, have more peace. Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, thanks for your talk very much. My question is about your work with people who perform under extreme pressure, elite athletes. I've read some of your work. I'm curious, are there any kind of particular methods you use when working with people who perform under extreme pressure, or is there a certain kind of teaching that is particularly applicable to them?
There's mindfulness and wisdom and just really being clear and being present and problem solving, but mostly it's about getting rid of the noise and the clutter so you can be. So what I mean by that is we have all these thoughts and we have all of this. So for instance, if you're talking about athletic competition, but it's the same for us, we call it forethought. So like there's a Super Bowl game going on tonight. So who's going to win is probably going to be determined by the thoughts they were having and the scenarios they were playing out in their head before today and their belief systems and their motivation and stuff like that, because the moment can change. One play happens, and then people lose confidence or whatever. So it's about knowing your forethought and knowing that it's your quality of mind that you have while you're observing mind while you're performing that's going to make all the difference. And so it's the same for us. It's like, you know, you go in a house or something happens and get a phone call. How are you going to react to that phone call? Has to do with all the thoughts and all the mindfulness you've had up to now and the choices you made. So if you're being mindful and you're cultivating wisdom and you can be in the eye of the hurricane and you can create space no matter what happens, if you know your intention, you can choose choices that are consistent with that. So it's nothing special. It's about be still and know, but really understand who are you being and how are you going to do what you're going to do. So we might call it, you know, clear comprehension, like what's your purpose, intention, what's the best way to do it, right? And then your domain of practice is daily life. So you got to be doing it not just in the game, but before the game, you got to be building that up. And then you got to deal with impermanence, no self, and suffering. those things are operating all the time. So how we relate to them with the opposite of the mind, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, is helpful. But it always comes down to this moment sets up the next moment. And if you can be in the moment and you can be in flow, that's how you get in flow. You're challenged, but your skill level is high enough. And you are in that, you get comfortable being uncomfortable. There's no way around that. Yes?
George, I totally love you. You know that, right?
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Yes. Oh, what time is it? Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Got carried away with the questions. So I appreciate that. So I had no idea what time it was. So thank you. So we'll have some Q&A tomorrow, so people who haven't been answered will answer questions later. So thank you all. And it's walking, right? Or is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Jordan,
yeah.
Maybe the next sitting should be at 9:15.
So. Okay. Yes, yeah, so we're going to walk for a half hour, I guess, and the next sitting will be 9:15. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.